This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work integrates research and field experience to prepare professionals to address today's most pressing problems in social justice, health, poverty, families, and global development. Applications are open for the early deadline of December 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future. Hey, Chicago. I'm Lisa Labas. I'm in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Now, today on the show, how is immigration enforcement in Chicago impacting kids and Chicago public schools? We'll hear from a CPS board member, a child psychologist, and a teacher. But first, this added pressure on our kids is amping up stress and fear. Solution? Maybe the outdoors. We also spoke with two members of a local nonprofit organization called Faith and Place. And here to give us a quick summary of that conversation is our In the Loop senior producer, Sienna Greaves. Hey, Sienna.
Hey, Lisa.
All right. So we heard how it's really hard right now for young people to get outside at the moment with all the increased immigration enforcement.
Yeah, Lisa, for several weeks on the show, we've discussed the impact of increased immigration enforcement on communities and businesses. Today, we really highlighted how ICE actually have eroded a sense of safety for kids. The number of safe spaces for kids in the city is shrinking. Schools, which is usually, you know, a place for friends and snacks and fun, now kids are dealing with soft lockdowns, canceled after-school activities, and all of this upheaval is really having an impact on their mental health and the mental health of their teachers.
Right, yeah, the teachers who are supporting the students, they need support themselves.
And not just schools. Kids are scared to go to parks and playgrounds.
And we spoke with organizers from a nonprofit group called Faith in Place. This is a group that's really highlighting this outdoors issue, and here's what they had to say.
It was many of our youth's first time going camping. A lot of our youth are from the city. We go on an annual camping trip, and this year it was an amazing camping trip. We went to the Manistee National Forest.
Oh my gosh.
Absolutely.
Beautiful.
We got to watch the sunset on the sand dunes on Lake Michigan, and it was just an amazing experience. We taught them how to take photos. We had a teaching artist there helping them take landscape photos, portrait photos, and the whole initiative there was to help them take photos in nature with the theme of belonging in nature.
You know, I'm not a camper.
No. I am.
It's not really for me, but that was like, you know, a really powerful conversation. I mean, these kids are living through history. This is something that, you know, haven't experienced in my lifetime. You know, you haven't. I couldn't imagine being afraid to leave my house.
No, I know. I do love camping, so I'll set it up and you can come with me. You just come and sit down at the fire.
Okay, just the once. I'll give it a try.
Okay, all right. You don't have to stay. You just stay for an hour. Okay. Thanks, Sienna.
Thank you, Lisa.
At the table, we have Norma Rios Sierra, artist, activist, and a member of the Chicago School Board, also a CPS parent. We've also got Rebecca Martinez, who recently worked as a history teacher at Little Village Lawndale High School, and she's a current member of the Chicago Teachers Union. And Dr. Rebecca Ford Paz, who is a child clinical psychologist and advisory board member of the Coalition for Immigrant Mental Health. Norma, I want to start with you. ICE and Border Patrol activities are still happening near schools. What's the latest as you know it?
Yeah, it's been terrible. It's been devastating. I know that CPS has been working since January to revise protocols and literally prepare for this moment. But there's really not enough preparation that can happen in order for us to be able to protect our children from the trauma that they are witnessing. We're grateful for the safety patrols that are happening within the community, and I think that that's essential for helping our children get to school. But we're still seeing drastic drops in attendance. I know that principals are working one-on-one with families, but there's still a desperate need to offer virtual options for our families.
Sure. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that in a little bit. But first, Rebecca, I want to ask you, until very recently, you were teaching at Little Village Lawndale High School. And I know you were there a couple of weeks ago when some of those most intense actions from ICE were happening in the community. Tell us what you saw.
Yeah, so I'm a history teacher. I was teaching 10th graders and 12th graders during the time where the most the intense occupation was happening in Little Village. You know, I was in a classroom with students, and it really, students were devastated. They felt powerless. They felt like the community was dealing with these armed agents, and they were inside the school, and they wanted to do something. They wanted to protect their neighborhood. They wanted to protect their parents. They wanted to protect their community. And they did look defeated. I mean, many of us cried. Students were sad. You know, I took it as an opportunity to, find ways to support them in their emotional well-being, but also just trying to also think about like the moment that we're living in, that we're living through history, and that as young people, they do have agency. And I think it was really important for them, at least what I saw, when the following week they staged a walkout. And they, students from the whole campus walked out, and they looked different after that. They felt more hopeful. They looked strong. They felt supported by the community and by elected officials who were like telling them, "We are proud of you for the action that you took." And I think, you know, as a teacher in the classroom, teaching about history from 100 years ago versus, you know, the role that we play today as young people and as people living through what seems more and more like a authoritarian government. These are very key moments in their development and life. They're also dealing with a lot that, yeah, I would be happy to talk more about some of that.
We can get to that in just a minute. Dr. Ford-Paz, I want to hear your reaction to what you're hearing here.
Yeah, absolutely. Separating a child from their parent can be one of the most traumatic experiences that can happen to a child. Children depend on their primary attachment figure for emotion regulation and for feeling safe. And so when there's a constant threat of deportation, of losing a family member, children can never really feel safe. So what we're seeing is that this is very traumatizing for many children in our communities.
Okay. What else are you seeing with this current anti-immigrant climate impacting children? Do you have any specific stories that you could share?
I'd like to talk kind of about what we mean by trauma. When we think about trauma, there's a definition offered by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration that consists of the three E's. So we first think about the event. And events that usually pose a threat towards either a child or a child's loved one's well-being and safety. It can be a one-time event, like a car accident or an assault, or it can be chronic stressors, such as domestic violence. Secondly, we think about experiences. Now, people can experience the same event very differently, depending on their own personal histories, depending on their developmental stage, their strengths and protective factors that they possess, and access to social support. So the bottom line is that not every trauma-exposed child will be traumatized. Mm-hmm. And then we think about effects of the events, long-lasting effects on functioning and well-being, including difficulty trusting other people, regulating emotions, and coping with daily stressors. Okay. I want to emphasize that chronic traumatic stress and accumulation of traumatic events over time can be very damaging for mental health in the long run. Sure. And many refugee and asylum-seeking children have already experienced pre-migration stressors in their country of origin that drove their families to flee violence that might have been cartel violence, it might have been trafficking, it might have been torture and persecution. Then we see many kids experiencing trauma on their journey to the United States, including human trafficking, physical and sexual assault, abuse by law enforcement, starvation. So what's happening now is layering on top of that. Sure. It's another layer of post-migration trauma.
Okay. Norma, would you say Chicago public schools are safe?
I adamantly believe that our children are safe in our schools. I think that we have excellent staff and administration that genuinely care about the safety of our students. I think that there's just no way to avoid them seeing the trauma outside of our schools.
There have been a lot of calls, as you mentioned, for remote learning. Can you tell us where do things stand right now?
Yeah, so CPS offers different types of remote learning. And what we saw during COVID was hybrid learning. That was state mandated by ISBE and requires a state of emergency issued by the governor.
Okay, that's the Illinois State Board of Education.
Yes, ISBE. And so that would be the easiest way to pivot to remote learning and would offer hybrid options across the district.
Mm-hmm.
We also have Virtual Academy, which is mandated by our own local board of education, and that would require policy change and is right the way that that policy is right now would only offer 5 days of virtual learning with a 30-day notice and a diagnosis from a doctor.
So if I got a diagnosis and the advance notice, I could only get 5 total days?
5 total days.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Is there a plan to maybe suspend grades for certain students?
Absolutely. We're looking at a lot of different options. Right now, what we're seeing are principals are working case-by-case basis with some families. And so we're also offering excused absences. So mm-hmm. if a parent is not bringing their child to school, they have the option to go on GoCPS and choose the option that is concerned for student health and safety.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, Rebecca, I want you to weigh in on remote learning. As a teacher, you know, I know this can be complicated and challenging. Is it a good option, though?
I think the moment that we're in needs everybody to consider what are the options.
Sure.
I think there are options that Ms. Sierra already named that exist that are current CPS policy, like the Virtual Academy. And if the district can make a policy, they can undo a policy or expand on a policy. So I feel like there are some short, some quick changes that can be made that would make it possible for students who are not currently attending school to have a virtual option. If it's a 5-day period, what's the policy to extend it to a 10-day or a 15-day a virtual option? So I think like trying everything that we can right now. You know, yesterday I just gave somebody a ride home and they shared with me that they haven't sent their child to school in weeks, mm-hmm. right? And they had their partner kidnapped. And so, you know, this is the reality.
Yeah.
And if we're not seeing students showing up, then I think we need to figure out what we can do immediately
so
right now.
So then what kind of resources do you think teachers and need to support kids right now? What do you physically need?
Yeah, I mean, look, the last few weeks have been difficult. I think our students are carrying a lot. You know, students have told me, Ms. Martinez, I'm 15, right? I'm worried about my dad. I'm worried about how if he gets abducted, who's gonna earn money in my household? Students taking on grocery shopping, students taking their younger siblings to school, and so they're taking on a lot. And as a teacher, I feel like I'm taking on a lot as well.
Sure.
Right. And I think what I absolutely need is the support of the district. I think right now with everything that we're dealing with, what I don't need is any budget cuts that I know that are looming. in the city, right? And that's why we need the mayor's budget to pass with the massive surplus, TIF surplus, so that we don't feel those impacts, those budget mid-year cuts, because that would mean just less resources at the school level and social emotional supports that our students need right now.
Right, exactly. And I want to ask Norma this. Is there money, are we bringing emergency money in for more counselors? Is that something that the kids need right now?
You know, Rebecca's absolutely right. We're already seeing a massive deficit, and we absolutely need the TIF surplus to pass in order to just make up that deficit. We are also committed to covering money that we've lost through federal cuts as well. So we're already working on making up the difference in that case. And so my concern is, that we won't have resources, or that it'll be very difficult to procure resources that would assist in this, in these crisis situations, if we don't have that full TIF surplus.
Right, but I know that, like, the district had cut the number of counselors, you know, in each school, and we need them back. Is that what you're saying?
We need, yes, absolutely. We need our counselors back. We need our maintenance workers back. We need safe passage to be expanded. Yeah. We need crossing guards at every corner. Absolutely, the budget that was passed solidified those cuts that are definitely impacting the classroom. And so absolutely, we need to make up that difference, and we need to find additional revenue options to help support the additional resources that we're going to need for our schools, especially mental health services.
Okay, and speaking of mental health, I want to go back to Dr. Ford-Paz. Now, the stories and the videos that so many of us have been seeing show a lot of chaos. Talk about how this uncertainty in routine can impact kids.
Yeah, so absolutely. We need to think about what kids need to overcome or recover from trauma. And they need three things. They need a sense of physical and psychological safety. They need to build connections and a feeling of belonging. And they need emotion regulation strategies. And what's happening is kids are losing their primary attachment figures, which means they don't have that support for emotion regulation and feelings of safety. Kids also feel safe when there's predictability and consistency. So constant changes in routine, chaotic environments, changes in caregivers cause children to become more dysregulated. Mm-hmm. When adults are losing their tempers and screaming profanities at law enforcement, blowing whistles, that's very overstimulating. Children, again, feel very unsafe. When it comes to building connection, children who don't leave home are feeling very isolated. They're not able to connect with their friends, their peer group. And children who are leaving their homes are feeling ostracized and othered when they watch the news, when they are bullied by their peers and told to self-deport, when they watch people who look like them being tear-gassed and hauled away like they were violent criminals. Mm-hmm. And when we think about emotion regulation, it's impossible for kids to really find that calm space to relax if they're surrounded by whistles and crying friends and neighbors and constant fear and threat.
Right. So this is what I'm hearing is some real short-term impacts. But what about long-term impacts? What do you think might some of those be?
Yeah. Highly stressful experiences like parent-child separation can cause irreparable harm and disrupt a child's brain architecture and development. It can impact not only their mental health, but also their physical health in the long term. I'm talking about things like hypertension, heart disease, cancer, diabetes. Children's inability to come in for treatment if they had a pre-existing condition due to fear of leaving their home makes it more likely that their mental health conditions go untreated. So when we see chronic traumatic stress over the long term, we're going to see difficulties with emotion regulation, difficulties with relationships, aggression. And also kids with anxiety and depression, if they're not getting their treatment, it can lead to serious maladaptive coping strategies such as suicidal thoughts and behaviors, self-injury, and substance abuse.
Okay. We're going to have to wrap this up very soon, but I want to ask you each another couple of things. First, Rebecca, what do you think about in the aftermath of these intense and aggressive intimidation enforcement actions that you saw a couple of weeks ago? What guidance did Little Village Lawndale, the school, receive from the district?
Yeah, I mean, I felt that we didn't get any acknowledgement that what happened happened. I think it was a very traumatic experience, and there wasn't a letter saying, you know, we recognize it was a traumatic experience. We're making available these resources, counselors, social workers, mm-hmm. Similar to when a shooting happens at a school, right? That I think like would have been helpful. Maybe we would have taken advantage of them, maybe not, but the just having them available would have been a recognition of the stress and trauma that we were experiencing at the time.
Sure.
I also think that like our students are experiencing much more than, you know, this is intense, and students across the district are facing SNAP benefit cuts,
right?
And food insecurity and cuts to healthcare. And so just like seeing the attacks of the Trump administration much more broader, right? That yes, it's multi-layered in our communities, unfortunately,
yeah.
Right? And one impact is ICE, and that's very visible and present. And students are going hungry. Yeah. And just like we need to also address that and think about that in a much more broader way.
Norma, I need to know specifics. What is the school district recommending for parents as a response to ICE? If they're approached, if they're tailed to school, what is the district saying?
The district has specific protocols in place whenever ICE is near a school or if a parent is impacted. There should have been a crisis team that reached out and offered additional resources. I know that that team is very small and probably overextended as well. I mean, historically, CPS has not been able to implement things in an equitable way across the district. And I think that what we're seeing is a district in crisis that has historically been underfunded. And so when things like this happen, systems crash and things are left behind. And so, I mean, we have board members that have been pushing for remote learning options and additional resources. And there's always one crisis after another at CPS, right? If it's not another meeting is another charter school that is closing or another funding crisis that we're seeing.
To catch you up on the biggest stories of the day. At the table, we've got WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane, WBEZ immigration reporter Adriana Cardona-McGeegan, and sometimes investigative reporter Bob Herguth. There was a hearing yesterday on conditions inside the ICE processing facility in West Suburban Broadview, and here's Adriana with those details.
So I've heard from people, you know, through my reporting, who've told me very similar testimony as the one I heard yesterday during, like about a more than 6 hours hearing. The important thing about this hearing is that we had the opportunity to, or they had the opportunity to show the general public or like to describe what it's like to live or to have been detained at this facility. Mm-hmm. So we heard from 5 people who've been detained and 2 lawyers who've represented people who've been detained. And among them, the people detained there was a man who's been in Chicago for 35 years and who sobbed as he recalled the times that, you know, he was detained and couldn't sleep because of the conditions. He just overcrowded and just like, you know, kind of like sitting down and being able to like really rest. And we also heard from a woman who spent 5 days at Broadview, who left 2 small children with her brother. And she was tricked into signing a deportation document that she didn't really quite understand.
Okay.
She talked about filthy and unsanitary conditions and mentioned an instance when she and other detainees had to unplug the toilet in their cell with garbage bags because it was clogged and leaking.
Oh dear.
She also says that she asked for a broom to clean the cell she was in, and, you know, because it was so dirty. We also heard from Ruben Torres Maldonado, the man who's 16-year-old, is battling cancer. He was detained and recently released, and he spent some time at Broadview, and he also spoke about overcrowding, unsanitary conditions, and very limited access to water and food. All of them, you know, mentioned the same things.
Okay, and what arguments did you hear from the federal government lawyers?
So, yeah, it was interesting to hear, and we had the opportunity to also hear from the, you know, Department of Justice attorneys. I heard things like the conditions aren't as bad as, you know, to call them violations of people's rights, that they do provide access to, you know, certain things like pro bono attorney, a list of pro bono attorneys, that people are allowed to use the phones when needed, and that they have been given food and water as needed as well. They also like refute instances in which like some people say like, you know, or the challenge of like this, like, oh, you know, detainees are not given medicine. When they're asked, they say that they are, you know, they really don't know an instance in which detainees are not given medicine. But their versions of what their version of the reality inside this facility, it was very contradicted by the testimony of people and the two attorneys who testified yesterday.
Right.
The government asked the judge for operational flexibility that doesn't interfere with the government's responsibility to enforce immigration law before like granting a temporary restraining order, which is proposed currently. They fear that it could halt the government's ability to enforce immigration laws in Illinois.
All right. So walk us briefly through some of the reporting you and your Sun-Times colleague Lauren Fitzpatrick have done to confirm what's going on inside that. The people who are being detained, this is what's happening. Journalists, nobody's going in.
Yeah, throughout our reporting, it's just like yesterday's testimony pretty much validated like the testimony that other people have given me about the conditions inside Broadview. I mean, we're talking about people who, you know, obviously didn't have enough access to food, water, who just slept right next to the toilet. Throughout our reporting, like some of the stories that we put out there, we've known that the Broadview was built for a capacity of like some 236 adults to stay up to 12 hours each. And that time was extended last June to up to 3 days, something like that. And just based on the testimony of people yesterday and also testimony that I've heard or like, you know, interviews I've had with other people, like the place doesn't seem to have the capacity to even hold people for like, I don't know, like even 24 hours. Mm-hmm. It really seems that it's just really simply not equipped or has the resources to have people there.
Right. Bob, do you want to chime in? What are you thinking about when you hear about the conditions at the Broadview ICE facility?
Yeah, well, I've not obviously been inside it, so I don't know firsthand. But what comes to mind is, I mean, a lot of what I do as a reporter here is look at the intersection of government, politics, and religion, for that matter, and faith systems. That's just sort of a prism through which I see a lot of things. And, you know, so just one observation is this, that, you know, this administration, the Trump administration, has put a huge stock on and emphasis on this quote-unquote return to Christian values, in their words. And, you know, a central tenet, an underlying foundation of Christianity is just basic kindness. No matter what your politics are, you know, people need to be treated with decency and kindness. And if that's not happening, that's potentially, obviously, not legal, but also not very moral, even through their own prism. That's what comes to my mind.
Okay. Claire, the FBI is warning law enforcement agencies about some criminals. I don't think it's happened in Chicago. They've been impersonating federal immigration agents. Bring me up to speed there.
Right. So the FBI says that there have been 5 instances of fake U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents carrying out robberies, kidnappings, even sexual assaults. So Wired was reporting the incidents have happened across the U.S. You're correct. Not in Chicago that we know of, or at this point that the FBI knows of. The Bureau tells agencies to continue to ensure that officers are clearly identifying themselves when civilians civilians ask. But as we've, you know, seen in Sun Times reporting too, the judge, federal judge, ordered immigration agents to have clearly labeled IDs, right. Which
that was
is
Sarah Ellis, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. But in Lawrence Fitzpatrick reported this too, that, sure. You know, some of these IDs still are not clear. So it's still a problem mm-hmm. that we're seeing in Chicago, but hopefully, you know, this impersonation thing doesn't happen here.
Oh gosh. Hope so. Adriana, now today we've got another hearing in the lawsuit brought by media groups over ICE and Border Patrol tear gassing protesters and journalists. Tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, what some of our reporters and like our station, the Sun Times WBC, has been covering out there when we have, you know, like when reporting on these interactions between federal officials and protesters and also the media. I mean, we've seen the excessive use of force and yes, like, I mean, like residents are starting to see that as well when they are out there also recording these interactions. I know that Border Patrol, you know, Chief Greg Bovino says protesters are violent rioters. In many instances, we've seen videos and evidence of residents who are coming out to record and challenge what the federal government or federal officials are doing out on the streets.
Right. They're just, we're not protesters. We're just, you know, looking out in our neighborhood.
Exactly. So okay. I would just encourage people to think critically as to, you know, when our government right now spits out words. Like, what's the evidence behind those words, behind those sentences, behind those statements? And I think that collectively, our reporters, you know, at our station, and also like throughout the video taking of so many residents, we know where the evidence, what the evidence is showing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Claire, I want to skip over back to you. One of the reasons President Trump has given for increasing this immigration enforcement is he says there is way too much crime in Chicago, but the latest numbers, I think they show different.
Yes, the latest city data shows that violent crime in Chicago is trending downward. Mm-hmm. Homicides and shootings in October were down almost 40% compared to October of last year. There's also been a very steep decline in both robberies and carjackings. So carjackings dropped 49%. Mm. Robberies overall dropped 41%. And violent crime in Chicago has been actually trending downward since 2023, which also includes murders, which have been slowing down since 2021.
All right. Okay, so yeah, the numbers really don't show that.
Discrepancies.
Okay. I guess we'll see what the president has to say next. I want to talk a little bit about some money and politics stories.
Uh-huh.
You're digging into former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. He's running for office again. Tell us a little bit about his backstory, just a reminder.
Sure. So he's the son of the famed minister, Jesse Jackson Sr., civil rights leader and all that, and Jesse Jackson Jr. was in Congress for 17 years until resigning in 2012 and then pleading guilty in 2013 to misusing his campaign funds, basically treating it as a personal piggy bank to live a lavish lifestyle. And he went to prison and he was convicted along with his wife, mm-hmm. Who was then an alderman or had been an alderperson. And so, you know, and now he's on the comeback trail, and among the people that encouraged him to run again, as the second congressional district seat is vacated by Robin Kelly, who's running for U.S. Senate, was a state rep and Calumet City mayor named Thaddeus Jones. And Thaddeus Jones, as my story in the paper today illustrates, has been for several years under criminal investigation himself for misusing allegedly or potentially his campaign funds.
Okay, so it's where the money's coming from, not, you know, that he's being funded, but it's just who and where this money's coming from.
Well, right. And, you know, and so Thaddeus Jones has donated now to Jesse Jackson Jr.'s campaign fund. So there's perhaps an irony there, and also their political allies. And so it was just really kind of a first glimpse into who's giving money to Jesse Jackson Jr.'s campaign, because he only just started running recently, and they filed their first disclosure paperwork. So Thad Jones was among the donors, but also others, you know, with long ties to the Jackson family, like Pastor Meeks of the Salem Baptist in the far south side, who's a longtime family friend and ally of the family, some Operation Push folks. as well as other elected officials are kind of getting behind Jackson. He raised about $90,000 over the last quarter, which is not the most among some of the other candidates, but it's nothing to sneeze at.
Okay, another story you've been looking into is Chicago Teachers Union President Stacey Davis Gates, who was recently elected to be president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. That's the statewide teachers union.
Yep.
And in that role, she would be able to deliver more money, more funding for Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson if he decides to seek reelection. What did you find there?
Yeah, potentially she would. I mean, so, the CTU is a subset of the IFT, and the IFT is a subset of the AFT, right? And they're all teacher unions, and Stacey Davis Gates has been the head of the CTU for a while and now just was elevated to the IFT, which potentially, and I say potentially because she won't talk about this or answer any questions, but the records show that the IFT has a PAC, Political Action Committee, of about $2 million and has given previously $1 million to Brandon Johnson in recent years. So this, her ascent to overseeing this parent organization now potentially gives her control or at least more influence in this PAC, just as her ally, Brandon Johnson, is presumably going to run for reelection.
Okay. Claire, I want to, before we wrap this all up, but what else are you watching? Is there anything fun and interesting going on in the city?
For Northwest Siders, especially those who like ribs, Chicago's Gale Street Inn is actually going to reopen. This is a Jefferson Park institution, some might call it. And it has a new owner, Sun Times reports, who's going to open the restaurant in December, reopen it. It had closed previously in June. It was open for more than 60 years, but it closed due to staffing shortages, saying it could never get back on its feet after the pandemic. But here we are, ribs for all, yet again.
I saw it got a little snazzed up a little bit. So
you'll have to dine in,
shall I? Okay. Adriana, leave us with this. What's the top story you're watching going forward with immigration enforcement?
I will say, I'll continue to just do so many updates on whatever is happening with some of these court cases. At the same time, I feel like I'm also always paying close attention to people on the ground, to immigrants on the ground, like who are those being detained and taken. And, no story is too similar. Mm-hmm. And even though we hear from so many people talking about the conditions at Broadview right now, I've heard just so many accounts of that. But to me, it's just so important that we continue to document.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.
Rise and Shy, WBEZ is serving local stories for breakfast every weekday morning from 5 to 11. Tune in on the WBEZ app to hear what Chicago's talking about as you start your day.